You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation strengthens education in northern New Mexico so that learners of all ages can reach their full potential, offering grants that fund public education and community projects, building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood programs, providing K-12 wraparound services for students and teachers with Inquiry Science as the flagship initiative, investing in students' dreams through scholarships, and creating a solid foundation for learning and systemic change through partnership and advocacy. For program information or to give, visit lanlfoundation.org. I'm very happy now to welcome Nina Simons. She's co-founder of Bioneers. She's author of several books. Her new book is called Nature, Culture, and the Sacred, A Woman Listens for Leadership. She will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Thursday, the 14th of March, in conversation with Cecile Lipworth. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here with you.
Good to be here, too. So you are co-founder of Bioneers, and you have been taking leadership roles for about 30 years, which is Bioneers is about to celebrate its 30th anniversary. How has your sense of and even definition of leadership changed over these decades?
That's such a great question. Well, it's evolved quite a bit. I think I first was drawn to really investigate leadership when I started being acknowledged for my own leadership. And I found I had a very confusing reaction, which was that some part of me was flattered and I knew it was supposed to be a good thing. And another part of me just wanted to deflect it and felt like, no, I haven't earned this. I don't want the attention. I just didn't want to be labeled that way. So I began to explore what are some of my own inherited definitions of leadership, and I realized that I had a lot of negative associations with it. I realized that without ever consciously adopting these ideas, I had come to feel that leaders were typically the charismatic people in the front of the room. They were often kind of dominant. And what I began to understand the more I looked at it was that they often had authority by nature of a title or a graduate degree or some kind of external authority that had been conferred on them. So I began this exploration about leadership because I knew from Bioneers that there were leaders that I had heard over the years who totally lit me up. And that when I heard them, I just went, yes, I want to be like that one.
What was that? Like, describe that one.
That one. Well, oh gosh, there's so many. You know, one of the that ones is a woman named Diane Wilson, who is a fifth generation Texas Gulf shrimper with a high school education. She had five kids. One of them had autism. And when she discovered that her county in southern Texas was the most toxic in the nation, she went ballistic. And she basically started educating herself about how she could go up against these multinational chemical corporations and get them to change their practices because she knew that it was poisoning her family. And so she became this wild, raving activist and started filing legal briefs and also did direct actions where she would chain herself, you know, to an effluent pipe. And she actually had a lot of success. And I remember hearing Diane, who part of what she said was, the way I know I'm on track is that I smell my fear and I head straight for it. And at the time I thought, wow, that sounds like a load of macho crap. But then I couldn't stop thinking about it. And so I tried applying it to myself, and I realized that the things I was most fearful of writing about were the things I cared about the most.
What were some of those?
Well, my ongoing learning about racial equity. I feel like I'm always on a learning edge with that, learning what it means to be born into a culture of whiteness, learning that there is there are all these nuanced, subtle, and unconscious behaviors that we learn, and learning something about how to sensitize myself to how those behavior patterns land in people of color and Indigenous people. So that's an example.
You said running toward your fear. What were you fearful of in terms of racial equity?
Well, here's an example. I told a story from the Bioneer stage that I consider the moment when my privilege was pierced, because there was just this giant breakthrough for me of knowing what was right in my head and then moving it to my heart. And when I told that story, I really remember standing on the stage and thinking, I could die. I felt like I was jumping off a cliff. I had all these scenarios in my head that I would either make racial wounding worse because I was not very skilled at it, or I would offend somebody or hurt somebody. You know, it was just the, and what I realized afterwards was that fear of breaking with white solidarity and sort of naming something that I was learning has a kind of irrational grip on me and perhaps on other white people. And it was really helpful to realize not only did I not die, you know, I imagined myself sort of jumping off of a building and landing splat on the pavement, you know, but there were a number of people of color and have been through my life since then who've come up and said, because of that story, I decided you were trustworthy.
Well, can you tell us the story?
Sure. I was co-leading a women's leadership workshop at a beautiful rural retreat center in northern New Mexico at high altitude. And we had a very diverse group of women there. And my co-facilitator in that work was Toby Hertzlick, who many people locally may know. And when we were arriving, a woman of African American descent had shown up there and said, I have asthma, and I've just realized that I forgot my inhaler. Well, I didn't really have much experience with asthma. So I kind of knew, okay, I need to watch out for her and be aware and watchful. But I didn't know exactly what it would mean if she had an asthma attack. And on the last night of our training, sure enough, we all went to bed, and about 3 a.m, her roommate came and woke us up. Come quick, she's having a terrible attack, I don't know what to do. So Toby and I sort of split up. I went to her room, while Toby went to research online what to do for an asthma attack, because we were easily an hour and a half from the nearest hospital. And I went into her room, and she was a remarkable environmental justice leader who, over the course of the week, I had really heard tell her story. I had become quite enamored of her courage and her commitment and really come to respect and admire her a great deal. And as I walked into her room, I found her gasping for breath in her bed and looking terrified. And I was terrified because I didn't know what to do for her. What I wound up doing was that because I had no information in my head about what could help her, I dropped into my body to get instructions. And what I got was that I should hold her and rock her and try to entrain her breathing with my own, just by breathing really deeply and making sounds as I breathed. And then I began humming to her as I was breathing and rocking her. And eventually, I don't know how much was because of what I did, but eventually her breathing started to calm. And I was so relieved. And as her breathing stilled and slowed, I laid her back on her pillows and I sank to the floor beside her bed, and I couldn't stop crying. I just realized I was like pouring tears. And I imagine some of it was relief, but some of it was also that I realized that no matter how long I had known about the injustices of toxic industries being sited in the poorest neighborhoods and of the higher incidence in African American communities of heart disease and asthma and obesity, I had known all of those things from my mind. And what had happened for me in that experience was that the knowing shifted from my head to my heart. And I felt simultaneously sort of embarrassed and ashamed as I recognized that knowing it in my head was so different than knowing it in my body and my heart. It was just a giant wake-up call for me that from that point forward, I became a different kind of advocate.
How did that change? What changed?
Well, what changed, I think, gosh, that's such a good question. I think what changed was my willingness to take risks, you know, and my willingness to break silence, my willingness to, I mean, I'm still in it, honestly, Mary Charlotte. I feel like this may be part of my whole life trajectory, but my yearning is to stand at the backs of women of color who are leading change, because I am so awed by the resilience and perseverance and quality that they bring to making sure no one has to go through what they went through. And I feel like I have a different understanding and a deepening understanding of what it means to leverage my own privilege on behalf of those issues and people and causes. So I'm in an ongoing inquiry. You know, I just took an amazing 3-day workshop with a woman named Robin DiAngelo, who wrote a book that's a New York Times bestseller right now called White Fragility. And she's brilliant. And it's really opening my eyes to some new ways of seeing things.
When you talk about leveraging your privilege in the service of others, what's an example of that?
Let's see. Well, one example is that sometimes, for instance, because I am a co-founder of Bioneers, I've had a lot of experience as a fundraiser. And I have friends and colleagues, some of whom are on the board of Bioneers, and others of whom are just extraordinary Indigenous women leading climate action efforts. And so periodically, if someone is in a crunch and has a proposal that they need help getting funded, I will reach out to people who I imagine really may resonate with their issues and concerns in an effort to help them raise money. So that's a way that I would be leveraging my social capital on behalf of their efforts. It means, you know, it challenges me to live by the values that I've come to embrace, which are that we can live in a win-win world. You know, I really feel like part of that journey with leadership was recognizing that leaders don't have to win by others losing, and that standing for and with other people and negotiating any difference with a presumption that it's possible to find a win-win solution is essential, you know. And earlier in my life, I used to think maybe that was naive of me, but I've come around now to thinking, no, it's the way the world has to work. And it's how we know when we're on track.
Yeah, it's such an interesting concept because, I mean, we, most of us probably who are listening to this show, believe in democracy. And in democracy, you have elections. And every election, somebody wins and somebody loses. And we've become divided. I mean, I think we've always been divided as a country. I mean, the idea that, you know, there's so many different echo chambers on the internet. There have always been echo chambers. In the 19th century, there were echo chambers. And so we're living in this world where there are. I mean, if you want to enact policy, mm-hmm. you got to run and yeah. you got to win.
Yeah.
And somebody else is going to lose.
Yeah, it's true. Well, and you know, I hope we may evolve toward a more pluralistic governance structure at some point so that there is room for a multiplicity of voices. You know, still there will be someone running and someone losing, for sure. You know, and I'm so excited to witness what's going on in the House now and all the women that are running for office at all levels.
Well, it's been a very interesting moment in our history that has been stimulated by having somebody in the White House who brags about grabbing women's private parts. you talk in your book quite a bit about masculinity and femininity and the imbalance of those two forces in society, in leadership. Talk more about that, because, I mean, sometimes it's hard to define even what those things are.
Absolutely. And I think we all suffer from having inherited definitions that are not very accurate, you know. I don't think femininity is pink and lacy and frilly, nor do I think that masculinity is necessarily saber brandishing. But, you know, what I find within myself is that I sometimes think of it as rigor and compassion, like holding myself accountable is sort of my masculine part. And my capacity for empathy and compassion and relational intelligence, I think of often as my feminine part and embodied intelligence. But, you know, what I'm finding the more that I study racial equity is that it's not as clear as a binary around gender. I'm finding that there are human attributes that previously, in a rather simplistic way, I had attributed to masculine and feminine, that in some cases have to do with white culture. And, you know, what are some of the, again, unseen, because fish don't see the water we swim in, attributes of what does privilege look like when children learn by the time they're 3 or 4 that being white is good and is better.
What does that have to do with masculinity and femininity?
Well, what it has to do, thank you, what it has to do with them is that there are things that I had previously attributed to being relics of a patriarchal culture that I actually believe are also a legacy of a racialized culture.
And what are some of those things?
Well, what I've noticed, and this is some of what I'm learning through the Robin DiAngelo work, is that white people in a mixed race setting, white people tend to speak up first. They're often the loudest. They have a tendency, have a tendency to sound like we know what we're talking about even when we don't. And so there's an undercurrent of dominance, which I had attributed to patriarchy. And now I'm sitting here going, oh, it's more complex than that. And perhaps it's this intersection and it's this tendency that we humans seem to have for creating hierarchy.
Which goes way, way, way back.
Indeed.
To our, really to our primate roots. Mm. And one of the things I think is so interesting, having talked to anthropologists about hunter-gatherer culture and primate culture, is primate culture is very hierarchical and hunter-gatherer culture is very egalitarian. Mm. And we draw on both of those legacies in our own cultures, which have both strains, egalitarianism and hierarchy, so much imbued into them. And they're always at war with each other.
That's so interesting and true. And then when you add to those two legacies the overlay of what organized religion has reinforced, right, then there's a whole nother separation of people from nature and a separation of people from the sacred. You know, I feel like we're in a moment of extraordinary opportunity to reinvent culture and reinvent really how we live on earth and with each other.
Which is a lot of what the work of Bioneers is.
Yep.
Regenerating air, land, water, ecosystems, and also human cultures. How does the ecosystem work of really thinking about regenerating, like whether it's our agricultural systems or our wild places, or our oceans, our rivers, making those really clean and healthy? How does that whole set of work feed into how we think of ourselves as social beings?
Well, one of my favorite metaphors actually comes from Janine Benyus. And Janine Benyus is kind of known as the godmother of biomimicry, which is the emergent field of learning how nature does things, like how does nature create conditions conducive to life. And of course, one of the systems errors that we've made is imagining that as people, we're apart from nature rather than a part of nature. And she says that in nature, the places of greatest innovation and creativity are the places where two or more ecosystems meet. And so, you know, at the edge of the forest where the river meets the ocean is where those three ecosystems meet. You have the greatest amount of new ideas and creativity. And so I believe that that principle must also therefore hold true for human intersections, and that part of what's, I believe, central to the work ahead is that in many ways we have been socialized to be most comfortable with people who look like us or people who feel like us. And in fact, in order to really inhabit this moment of co-creativity, we need to orient ourselves towards diversity being our greatest asset, because that's where the new ideas and new inventions come from.
Right. And in nature, stress also is the raw material for creativity.
Absolutely. And Lord knows we're getting a lot of that right now. But also there is the question of how do we face trauma in such a way that we don't fall into a loop of recycling our own painful stories and perpetuating them. How do we break the cycle of hurt people hurting people? You know, and there are certain social innovations like restorative justice work, for instance, that can help shift that pattern. And so I'm really interested in how we learn all we can from nature to reinvent human society and civilization.
This is a long-term project, and it's something that in a way we can't fully direct, just like nobody directed evolution. Nobody said, oh, let's make humans. Okay, we're going to start with a cell, and pretty soon we'll get there. It just happens, and we all sort of put our little pieces into it.
Exactly. It's a co-creative process, and it's an emergent process. And when you were asking about patriarchy and racialized culture, you know, I think we've all been socialized to imagine that if we're strategic enough and we plan well enough, then we can design the plan and follow the plan to a logical conclusion and reach our goal. Well, I don't think that's how the world works, as you say. And so that's another one of the ingrained stereotypes, is really the legacy of rugged individualism and of head over heart. And so I think part of the culture shift we're facing is how do we get more receptive, which is why the book is called A Woman Listens for Leadership. How do we listen better for the guidance that can come from all kinds of sources and really be nimble enough to adapt how we're walking according to the guidance we get?
Listening is something that I think in the masculine feminine polarity, you know, which is, it's such tricky stuff because I don't like thinking that way myself too much, but listening is sort of a feminine thing. But the best leaders have always listened. Like mm-hmm. when I think about leaders whom I admire, Martin Luther King really kind of stands out, who really, really did listen and who was charismatic and mm-hmm. who did walk into a room and take up a lot of energetic space. Mm-hmm. But was also listening to everybody around him and being affected and changed by that.
Yeah. Well, I totally agree. And, you know, this is why the binary stuff is tricky, is that as human beings, of course, regardless of what gender identity we may ascribe to, we all have masculine and feminine within us. And, you know, my aim is to be what I call a full spectrum leader, which means having the really array of options of all my human characteristics and the sensitivity to adapt in the moment to what's called for, and honoring the best of my gifts without judging myself and doing greater harm to myself for what I'm not good at. Like, none of us is good at everything.
Lord knows that women need to learn to delegate.
And to stop beating ourselves up.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely.
So one of the things that I think is really harmful in terms of masculine and feminine stereotypes is the polarity of rational and emotional. Mm. And sometimes I think, like, if you take any stereotype, like this group of people is lazy, often it's the exact opposite of the truth.
Yeah.
And so the people who are called lazy are often the hardest working people
Yes.
In the town, right? And when you look at rational versus emotional, you know, men rational, women emotional, and you look at Washington, D.C., what I see is a bubbling cauldron of emotion, of anger, of ego, of will to power. None of those things is rational.
No, not at all. I feel like the demonization of emotions is one of the things we really have to turn around, because actually nature gave us emotions for very good reasons. And if we could reclaim a right relationship to emotion, then we could stop acting out and hurting each other in quite the ways that we are. But you're absolutely right. I mean, when I listen to the congressional testimony yesterday, it was stunning. It was stunning to hear the amount of emotion and aggression and the party line that was manifest there, you know?
We're talking about, so when we're recording this, it's the day after the Michael Cohen testimony in Washington, D.C. And if you flip it around and look at a lot of the issues that women and women leaders are interested in, it's things like having food and water that's not poisonous.
Yeah, it's pretty basic. I mean, it's interesting because I find myself, really, I consider myself a student of many indigenous cultures. And one of the cultures that I love to turn to is the Haudenosaunee or Iroquois Six Nations. And many people don't know that they are actually a source for much of our U.S. Constitution. And also what fascinated me was discovering that the women's suffragette movement, when they were looking for examples of where women's wisdom was valued, they looked in their own backyard in Seneca Falls and found the Iroquois Six Nations. And the women in that culture, which is very intact, the women actually choose the leaders, and they are responsible for the health and well-being of the people. So the women are facing inward, the men are facing outward in a kind of protective stance. And, you know, that seems to be kind of an ancient model. Again, I don't want to be too essentialist. I think, you know, women and men cross the boundaries all the time and with good reason, and thank heavens it's all getting more fluid. But it's true. The women in politics are concerned about our air and our water and our food and our education and our health and like some core infrastructure issues of our human society that are desperately in need of attention.
And which are eminently rational compared to things like
building a border wall,
or being great, or
yeah. Well, but it may also be that, you know, we have been evolved by nature to be mothers. While some of us may be childless by choice, still that capacity to monitor for what's needed in other people, which is endemic to being a good parent, you know, makes sense. It makes sense that there is a kind of heightened awareness of scanning for the good of the whole, and that, you know, part of toxic masculinity has been this over-identification with self and prestige and image and, you know, an inflated ego, essentially.
There's a whole new world of young women leaders now, women in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, and the generation that's older than they are kind of broke a lot of ground. Do you think it's made it easier for the next generation to become leaders, to be comfortable with leadership?
I do. And there are still so many systemic barriers that they face. You know, so there's an interesting combination of young women who feel and who are raised to believe they could do anything, they can do it all, and who simultaneously, just as I did when I came out of college, imagine that they're stepping onto a more level playing field than they actually are. And so to me, you know, part of the challenge that I see in young women's leadership is how do we create bridges so that we as elders can show up in a really respectful way for what I call mutual mentorship, because I certainly have as much to learn from them as they from me. you know, but I'm blown away by young women that I perceive. One of my favorites in the last few months is this extraordinary 16-year-old Swedish young woman named Greta Thunberg, who is a young woman with Asperger's, who has been speaking at the UN and the World Economic Forum about climate and leading student protests and student walkouts all over Europe. And she's amazing. She's extraordinary. And wow, is she truth to power, you know?
And the voices of young people are also making themselves heard in the New Mexico legislature.
Uh-huh.
And it's so interesting. We had on one of our recent shows some teenagers, high school young women, who were talking about the fact that when they go into these hearings and people have been talking and legislators are bored and they're looking at their phones, and then when young people come up, they put down their phones and listen.
Yeah, I bet. No, that's really great. And, you know, we're blessed in New Mexico, I think, to have a lot of organizations working really well on behalf of raising up the leadership of young women and young women of color in particular. And I think because we're a multicultural state, we have certain advantages in that way. And that's so exciting to hear that's happening locally in that way.
The book is called Nature, Culture, and the Sacred: A Woman Listens for Leadership. What are your hopes for this book?
Oh, my hopes are that it can serve as useful to women and men, but women in particular, of any age and any background, who are looking for inspiration and even some practical tools. I mean, part of what I really loved doing in the book was sharing really specific guidance for how do you tell a story in a way that can really move people, or how, if you're gathering a group that's multicultural, how can you create the conditions so that if divides happen around race or class, then you can have the best shot at repairing them. You know, so I loved giving, you know, I seem to be entering the phase of my life that I call yelderhood, which is sort of young elderhood. And
I thought you meant you were yelling.
No. I'm a yelder, thank you. And it seems to come with it. It seems to accompany a desire to pass along whatever I've learned that can be useful, you know? So yeah. I'm hoping for that. And also, I love standing on behalf of those human qualities that, because we've relegated them to the quote feminine, we've tended to undervalue. So, you know, in a way, my fondest dream is that some men and people of all gender identities will enjoy it as a celebration of those aspects of our humanity that tend to get short shrift.
And many other women are profiled in this book. Terry Tempest Williams is there, Eve Ensler, many others. Nina Simons is co-founder of Bioneers. She will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Thursday, the 14th of March, in conversation with Cecile Lipworth, who's another wonderful leader who worked for many years with Eve Ensler and V-Day, who is a real treasure here in Santa Fe.
Yeah.
So, Nina, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Mary Charlotte. Thank you. You ask great questions, and it's really fun to enter into dialogue with you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.